This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you so much, Parker. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. I can honestly say that there's never a time that I'm not excited to talk about a blues musician or talk to a blues musician. It doesn't matter if they're legendary or if they're just starting out. I proudly treat all of my guests equally because each brings a piece of history that we are preserving for future generations. Today's guest truly is legendary, and his pedigree in the blues is staggering. He is a 13-time Grammy nominee, a 2014 Grammy winner with Ben Harper, a 33-time Blues Music Award winner, and recipient of many Living Blues Awards to boot. Not bad for a guy that was quoted as saying, "It wasn't my goal to be a professional musician." He continued, "I just loved music, period." By my count, he has some 37 albums out there dating back to 1967, and his latest is a smoking new album called Lookout Highway, which we're going to be talking about shortly. Now, if you're looking for a blues harmonicist, this guy is most assuredly going to be on the short list of the top harp players in the world. Kosciuszko, Mississippi native, 40 Below record artist, and 2010 Blues Hall of Fame inductee Charlie Musselwhite. I am indeed honored to welcome you to Time Signatures. How are you?
Better than I deserve.
I guess the best place for us to start is to ask you about your earliest memories of music.
Oh gosh, in Memphis growing up, I remember the street singers in downtown Memphis. I was really fascinated with them as a little kid. You know, I'd see a guy on the corner with a guitar singing blues, you know, looking for tips. And there were several of them around, and I was too shy to talk to them, but I was fascinated and always would look for them when I was downtown in Memphis. And then there was another guy, I lived near these railroad tracks. I mean, close enough that the windows would rattle when the trains went by.
Oh, wow.
And there was a sawmill on this street called Scott Street that went under Summer Avenue. And there was a guy always down there playing guitar for guys when they got off from work from the sawmill. So I was fascinated with that too. And then later on, there was blues on the radio, and mm-hmm. I was looking for blues records around. I was going to junk stores looking for old blues records, 78s and 45s, and I'd find them in the used furniture stores too. And I still have a lot of them.
Nice.
And so there was the radio and the records and the street singers. And near my house where I grew up, there was also a creek called Cypress Creek. And there were some fields along those creeks that people would work in and sing. Even though it was in the middle of town, it was still kind of a piece of the country there.
Okay.
And hearing them singing in the fields, and I was a little kid hanging out at the creek because that was the coolest place to go on a hot day. It was down
yes,
by
sir.
The creek. And that music, I remember laying in the weeds in the shade trying to be cool and hearing them singing, and that music just sounded like how I felt. And it just wrapped itself around me. It became my comforter.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
Now, you also happened to meet a young guy by the name of Elvis down there around that time too, didn't you?
I had his phone number. I used to go to his parties, and I could call up and find out where the party was going to be. He would rent places around Memphis, like a theater or the entire fairgrounds he would rent. And he'd go from, the parties always went from midnight to dawn.
Wow.
And that was a lot of fun. I didn't really have conversation with Elvis. I'd just speak, "Hey, how you doing?" or something like that. But it was great to be in those parties with Yeah, but a lot of good-looking girls were there, I'll tell you that.
Now, I'm assuming from what I've read that the harmonica came first for you. Is that correct?
There was always harmonicas around, it seemed like, and in my memory, just about everybody had one. I mean, it was a
Okay.
back then they were real cheap, you know, a dollar or less or something, and
Wow.
so their harmonicas were around. And my dad had played some, and he didn't teach me anything. But when I was about 13, I remember listening to, I had all these Sonny Boy Williamson 78s, the first Sonny Boy, John Lee Williamson. And I loved the way he sounded on harmonica. And I got to thinking about it. It felt so good to listen to that. It must feel even better to play it yourself. And I thought, well, you have some harmonicas, you know. So I was familiar with the harmonica, but I never really thought about playing blues. So I started going out in the woods where I thought nobody could hear me, and I just started teaching myself. And then later on, I got to know some players around Memphis, like Will Shade. He had the Memphis Jug Band back in the 20s and 30s, and he played guitar and harmonica. And then my dad gave me his guitar when I was about 13. So when I was around 13, I started teaching myself blues on both instruments.
Wow. Wow. Now, by the age of 16, you were hanging out with some of the musicians that performed on the streets of Memphis, ultimately honing your skills for what would come just a couple of years later as you made your way to Chicago in 1962. Charlie, I have to ask you, man, did you have any idea of what you were landing in the middle of with that blues boom in that time of history when you got to Chicago?
No, I didn't. I knew nothing about Chicago except that it was a big city way up north and they had a lot of factory jobs. That's the total information I had on Chicago.
Wow.
When I was in Memphis meeting all these old-time blues singers and hanging out with them, and I had no goal at that point to be on stage or to play music professionally or be in the spotlight or nothing. I just loved the music, and I liked meeting these guys, and they were real receptive to me and encouraging, and they were flattered that I would come to them to learn from them and hang out with them. But if I had known, I would have paid a lot more attention. I was just having fun.
Between yourself and Elvin Bishop, Paul Butterfield, and Mike Bloomfield, you guys were front row center to the monster blues movement of that day. But it begs the question, how did four young white guys survive in a town known for its toughness even back then? I mean, I could imagine that it was a bit unnerving for you at times, wasn't it?
Not for me. I was from Memphis.
Okay.
And I never felt like that at all. I just, you know, it's interesting that as I got to know just about everybody in Chicago back then, Little Walter and Sonny Boy and Magic Sam and Muddy and Wolf, and when they would introduce me to somebody, they'd always say, "Now Charlie, he's from down home." Like that really meant something. I wasn't a local Yankee. I was from down home. I was like one of them. You know, we liked the same food and the same music. And when I first got to Chicago, the white people in Chicago could barely understand me, and I could hardly understand them. I had to really change my accent to be able to, like, order food in a restaurant. I'd ask for a glass of water. Back then, I'd say, "Water. I want a glass of water." "What? Glass of water." I'm saying a glass of water. I had to learn how to say water, not war. Stuff like that.
Yeah. I would love to hear about your ties to Little Walter and Big Walter.
Well, Big Walter was also from Memphis, and he had also learned from Will Shade, same as I did. Of course, Walter loved to tell big, tall tales, and according to him, he never even learned how to play harmonica. He just knew how to automatically. And Little Walter I saw both of them plenty around Chicago in the clubs and just on the streets too, just hanging out, walking the streets. I could go on and on about those guys. I have stories about them, and they were real friendly to me, and I really enjoyed their friendship, and we had some good times.
And you referred to them as two players that inspired you, didn't they?
Well, yeah, everybody had something that was interesting. I mean, both Sonny Boys and both Walters, and there was lots of guys that were around playing harmonica. Good Rockin' Charles, and gosh, I forget, Kerry Bell, and Wolf played. I even saw Muddy play harmonica one time. Not very
oh, no
well.
No kidding.
But he was. I remember him laughing and playing on stage at Pepper's Lounge.
Wow. Speaking of Muddy, I got to have you tell me the story about your first break with him. How did you get involved? And clearly it put you on a trajectory that has carried you through all these years. Yeah.
Well, I was going to see him often. I wasn't going around asking to sit in. I didn't even tell anybody I played. I was just coming from Memphis. I already knew how to drink. So I just fit right in these clubs, you know. I was just happy to be hanging out and socializing and enjoying the music. But I got to know this waitress real well, and I had played for her in her apartment. And at Pepper's Lounge, she went up to Muddy and said, "You ought to hear Charlie play harmonica." Now, he already knew me he just thought of me as a fan. You know, I would request tunes. But when he found out I played, well, he insisted I sit in, which wasn't unusual because a lot of musicians hung out at Pepper's Lounge, and a lot of Muddy would always have them sitting in because they went to 4 in the morning, you know. And Saturday night, they went to 5 in the morning. So that's a lot of time.
Yeah.
So Muddy was happy to have guys come by and sit in. So what was unusual was that this was really strictly adult and black music. You never saw a white teenager playing this music, so that was unusual. And a lot of musicians that were there that saw me sitting in with Muddy, because from then on, whenever Muddy saw me, he always had me sit in. And the other musicians saw me playing with Muddy and started offering me gigs. And wow, that got my attention. I still find it hard to believe you're going to pay me to play harmonica. Okay, let's go.
Now, how about that first album, Stand Back? I mean, that kind of really put things in motion as well, didn't it?
Actually, that was July 11th, 1966. You know, people today, they spend months in the studio doing an album. We did that album in under 3 hours.
The whole thing?
Yeah, that was all we had because Vanguard, the record label, was not going to pay double scale. And if you went one second over 3 hours, they would have to pay double scale. So Sam Carter, the producer, said, "You got 3 hours, knock it out." So we just did one tune after another, and that's it.
And unfortunately, it didn't get here in time, but I have a copy of that album coming because I wanted to have one and just be able to check it out, because it seems like being able to see some of your early work and listen to some of your early work sounds like a lot of fun to me. But
it's never been out of print. It's one of the few albums from 1966 that's always been available.
Well, and believe it or not, I found a copy on Discogs, and I wanted to have the original vinyl. I didn't want to repress. I didn't want to, you know, a reprint or anything like that, or CD. I wanted to actually have it, because I do have some vinyl here. But Charlie, your work as a musician eventually took you to California, and by that point the blues movement was rolling along in Chicago. Did you ever have any regrets for making that move, and what caused you to make the move out there in the first place?
Well, when Stand Back came out, then I started getting requests from different places around the country to come play. And I was so busy in Chicago, I just didn't see any point to going somewhere else. And Yeah, I was having a hell of a good time right there.
Yeah.
Well, this guy in the West Coast kept bugging me, and finally he put together a whole month of work for me, and for really good money, better money than I was making in Chicago. So finally I said, okay, I'll just go out there and do those gigs and come on back. Well, in that time that I was out there, I saw that there was all up and down the whole West Coast was these big rooms like the Fillmore Ballroom and the Avalon
Sure.
Ballroom and other, and so they were, since they were so large, they had a lot of more, they could pay you a lot more money, and they had the underground radio. They were, those guys could bring records from home and play them. They weren't given a playlist they had to follow.
Wow.
They played anything they wanted to play, so they were playing me. And so I had an audience already when I got there. People knew who I was. So right away, things were just way better than, the little clubs in Chicago, they just weren't big enough to pay that much money. And really, most of the guys had day jobs, except some guys like Muddy and Wolf and Walter. They were still putting out 45s regularly and touring, but the rest of those guys, we're driving trucks and working in factories and, playing on the weekends or playing whenever they could. So this was a whole new scene for me, and it just made sense to stay in on the West Coast.
Yeah, I have to ask you, when you talk about the having a fan base out there before you even arrived, what was that like for you as a young musician? That had to be a really heady time for you, yeah?
Well, it was still kind of a surprise that this record was getting such attention, and I was getting all these bookings, and and it also, on the other hand, it was like being thrown in the deep end of the pool, because I didn't know anything about the music business. I mean, in Chicago, we didn't have any contracts or nothing. It was a handshake deal.
Yes, sir.
So I didn't have a manager. I didn't have any booking agency or nothing. So I had to just learn by trial and error. And there was a lot of error on the way, figuring it out. I had nothing to base anything on. It was a whole complete new environment for me.
Yes, sir. Now, once you got settled out there, you even talked John Lee Hooker into joining you out there, didn't you?
Well, I don't know for sure if that's, but I remember calling John when he still lived in Detroit, and I'm out on the West Coast. I'm fresh out there, and I called up John and said, "Man, it's really great out here. You might want to come out and check it out." It wasn't long after that, he had an apartment in Oakland, so I'd like to think I had some influence there, and maybe
Sure.
that was it. Yeah.
Did you guys get to do any dates together, jam together, recording?
Oh, that happened all the time. He would often call me up, and if I wasn't working, he'd say, "Come on down and help the old boy out." And we recorded together many times.
Very nice. Now, you have now risen to the level of elder statesman of the blues genre. You've certainly paid whatever dues were necessary along the way to get to that status, Charlie. But is there any unfinished business in your life, musically speaking, anyone you'd like to record with yet, or anyone you wish that you could have recorded with as you were coming up?
Gosh, that's a long answer to a short question. One thing, if I could go back in time, it'd be great to go back to see Charlie Patton in his prime on a Saturday night. That would be like really a eye-opening, a real thrill for me to see Charlie Patton.
Yes, sir. Now, I have a couple of questions for you from a couple of our board members at the Capital Area Blues Society here in Lansing, Michigan. A gentleman by the name of Roger Gentry, better known as Kid Cincinnati, wanted me to ask you if you have any tips to share with harp players wanting to play a chromatic harp.
Well, just like, I remember Walter Horton, they called him Big Walter or Shaky. I called him Shaky. I would go over to his apartment often for lessons, but all we did was sit around and drink. But one thing he told me that really stuck with me was, he said, learn your patterns. So that's what I tell people, you know, the harmonica, there's different keys you can play in on the same harmonica, and it works for diatonic and chromatic. You can play it first position, which would be, if it's a C harmonica, you're in the key of C, but a second position would be G, and D is third position, and A is fourth, and A is fifth. I learned A from Shaky, and I learned fifth from Little Walter. You just have, since it's the only instrument, you can't see what's going on.
Right.
Every other instrument, their hands come in somehow, and it's all covered up, so it's all, you can't watch what somebody's doing because you can't see what they're doing. So you need to just learn the patterns. And I remember when I was first becoming aware of these other positions, how to play in that position, I figured, well, if you got an octave, there's got to be a way to get between those two notes, like little stepping stones up and back. And once you do that, you're in that key. So as you take one note and go, okay, what's the next note I want to hear? And you look for that note, and then you go to the next note. So that's the one way to learn a pattern. So I guess, you know, sit around and just play and figure it out. Play along with the other, with records or with the instrumentals, or they have backing tracks on YouTube you could play along to. And the more you play, the more you learn.
Yeah, and technology has really come a long way in allowing today's musicians to learn a lot quicker, I would think, because of the availability of all of that.
It's so much, incredibly more information than when I started out. There was nothing, there were no YouTubes, no CDs, no cassettes or books or videos or nothing. You couldn't even read about blues, except sometimes a book on jazz might have a little chapter on blues, but there was no blues. Today is blues magazines and blues societies and blues cruises and blues on and
yes,
on.
Sir.
None of that was around when I started out.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you've done some great things with Elvin as well. Obviously, coming out of Chicago together. What is your best memory, your favorite memory of playing with Elvin out there?
Oh gosh, every night we just have a ball playing together. We crack each other up. We're laughing. We're telling stories, telling lies, and it's just such a groove to play with each other. We both know the music so well, we don't have to rehearse or practice or nothing. We just name the key and count it off, and we're there.
You know, I had a chance to chat with him a few weeks back, and I told him I was trying to get an interview with you. He said, yeah, but Muscle White just called me this morning. We were just talking this morning. So you guys just seem like you have a good time when you're out there.
Well, we do. We're real good friends, and we love the music the same way, and we enjoy playing together, and we just groove.
Yes, sir. Well, your new album is out. It's called Lookout Highway, and it's a good one, recorded at Kid Anderson's Greaseland Studio. How cool was it to record with your longtime touring band for the first time?
Well, it wasn't really the first time. It was the first time in a long time. But,
okay.
It was. I've been looking forward to it for quite a while. We'd just been playing in New York City when the pandemic hit. We got back out to California, and so it was perfect timing because everything was shutting down, you know. So
yes,
we, it was great to be in at Kid's place, and there was some problems though, so I had to redo all the vocals and the harmonica here in Clarksdale, Mississippi. So it's a lot of good music happened, and I'm glad it's been recorded and it's out there and people are digging it.
Well, and while we're talking about the new album, I have to be honest, I'm having a hard time settling on just one or two tracks that I really enjoy. And I think that it might be the mix of the Delta and Chicago blues season with some Memphis soul in there, but I really have enjoyed the entire album, Charlie. You seem like you guys are just having a good time on this one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I always think if we're having a good time, then the listener is going to enjoy it more, you know, whether
yes, sir.
It's live or whether you're in a live situation or in the studio. So we do all love the music, and we're all friends, so it's easy to have a good time playing the blues.
Indeed. All right, man, here's the most important part of our chat today. Where can people go to learn more about you, maybe buy some CDs, vinyl, or merch, or book you for a gig?
Well, you can go on my website, charliemostofwhite.com, and all that should be available. You know, how to get a hold of me for booking, or if you want a picture, you can download a picture, or you can order a CD. Port Merch is the name of a place that sells my CDs, and it should all be there on the website. You can come at it on my gigs. I often go out to the lobby or wherever, and I'll sell CDs. So look for that.
Well, and rumor has it when you're in Clarksdale, you frequent the Mississippi Saxophone and Blues Emporium with Deke over there playing once in a while with him too, don't you?
Oh, yeah, he's just around the corner from me. I could walk there in about 2 minutes.
Well, when you see him, tell him I said hi. I actually have one of his harmonicas right here. I'm learning, and I'm 60 years old, so I got a lot of catching up to do.
Well, I'm 81, and I'm still learning. There's no end to learning.
There you go. Well, Charlie Musselwhite, I cannot thank you enough for your time today. It's been an honor, and I wish you much continued success.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Charlie Musselwhite, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.